So I'd like to welcome you all to this workshop. One of the aims of this workshop is to help you, if not understand everything in the area, at least get a broad overview of many of the ideas and the techniques and the problems that have been studied over the past 10 years in Galois representations, automorphic forms, and Shimura varieties. And especially what I hope you come away with at the end is just some idea of what the interesting problems are, what are some of the methods that have been used to solve them, what are some of the difficulties, what things work for classical modular forms, what things can be generalized, what things require new ideas. So I know that many of you have different levels of background. I hope that we would like to aim perhaps at the lowest common denominator as opposed to the person who knows the most. So if some of these early lectures cover material you have already seen before, I hope that that you will still at least get something out of them. In previous workshops, another workshop similar to this that was run by Florian, Matthew, Emerton, and myself, one thing we felt was that 20 hours of new material can be a lot to absorb. So hopefully we're not going to cram too much into you at once. So the first lecture is just going to be an overview of classical modular forms, and is hopefully going to cover some material that's familiar to be many of you. Okay. I'm going to start by talking about lattices and elliptic curves. So, definition, a lattice inside C just consists of a discrete embedding of the group Z squared into C. So in other words, it just consists, another way of saying that is it consists, we can write it in terms of a basis, omega 1 and omega 2, which is given by the multiples of two complex numbers, omega 1 plus omega 2, and the condition that it's an embedding is the condition that first omega 1 and omega 2 are both not equal to 0, but one is not a multiple of the other, or an integer multiple of the other. On the other hand, the condition that it's discrete is the condition that this ratio is not a real number. Okay, so let me just also check, what's the lowest point that can be read? Is this a point which everyone can read? Okay, maybe I'll just put a line there. So just a remark, of course, lambda does not determine the basis, omega 1, omega 2, namely, you can have other bases. In other words, omega 1 and omega 2 is equal to A omega 1 plus B omega 2 and C omega 1 plus D omega 2. Well, this is certainly, if A, B, C, and D are integers, this is certainly contained inside this lattice, but they're the same lattice if and only if the matrix ABCD is an automorphism of Z squared, namely an element of GL2Z. Okay. It's another definition. two lattices, lambda and lambda prime, are homothetic if there exists some non-zero complex number mu such that lambda prime is just the lattice lambda scaled by this constant. So certainly this is an equivalence relation on lattices. And then the first theorem about lattices, the first theorem about lattices is that if you take C and you quotient out by the lattice, then this is an algebraic variety. Okay. So this is probably familiar to most of you. What one has to do to prove this is to produce functions. I mean, so certainly geometrically it's just a torus, so it's certainly locally a complex manifold, so you have to take this complex manifold and find some functions that satisfy some algebraic relations. And Weierstrass came up with a way of doing this. Namely, you have to write down a function that's invariant under the lattice, so the obvious thing to do is just to take the sum of something over the lattice, so you can take the sum of 1 on z minus lambda, where lambda is in U. This is sort of the obvious thing to do, to take a function on the lattice. But the problem is this doesn't quite converge. When I say doesn't quite converge, I mean it doesn't converge. So in order to correct that, you can put in a square, and this now does converge, but it only converges it still doesn't converge. So you have to correct something here. So one thing you can do, well, in fact, one problem with this, if you let z is equal to 0, you get the sum of 1 on lambda squared, which I think is that conditionally convergent, but it's a problem. So you can correct it by subtracting off an infinity, namely you can subtract off a constant. So you have this, and this almost works, except for now the fact that you've included lambda is 0 here, which is not so good to subtract off 1 on 0. So you simply pull that term out, so lambda is not equal to 0, and then you add 1 on z squared. So this is a perfectly nice function. I'll call it x. And you can see it's a meromorphic function on C mod lambda that has a pole of order 2 at z equals 0, and at each lattice point. So you have this function. You also have a function y, which is just the derivative of this function with respect to z, which is equal to minus 2 on z cubed plus sum over the lattice, not equal to 0, of minus 2 on z minus lambda cubed. Okay. And then you observe that you can take various combinations of powers of this function, and if you come up with a function that observably doesn't have any poles, then it will be a function on the complex plane that doesn't have any poles, but moreover is periodic with respect to the lattice. And since that you can take a fundamental domain for the lattice that's compact, you'll see that it's even a bounded complex analytic function, which by Liouville must be a constant. So if you try and write down such a function, you end up writing down a function that's y squared minus 4x cubed, and then minus various combinations of x, which usually go by the name of, for various historical reasons, of 60g4 minus 140g6. So you compute this around z is equal to 0. So you observe that this is equal to oz as z goes to 0. So it's therefore holomorphic and bounded, therefore constant. And by checking its value at 0, it's therefore equal to 0. Actually, I mean, if it was O of 1, you would deduce it was constant. So I guess I'm just doing OZ, and you could even then subtract off that constant term. Well, this is the Laurent series in Z, and this is, I'm just saying that the first term is, it starts out as Z. Okay. Okay. Well, so, this gives you an equation between neuromorphic functions that are satisfied on this algebraic variety. You would have to check, of course, that the function field of this is actually the correct thing. But that essentially boils down to the following fact, is that there aren't going to be any functions on C mod lambda that just merely have a single pole. If you had a function that has a single pole at one point and no other poles, that gives you a map from C mod lambda to P1, that essentially it has to be degree 1 and it has to be an isomorphism, but for topological reasons, you see that can't be the case. Okay. So the second remark is that the following lemma is that C mod lambda is isomorphic to C mod lambda prime if and only if lambda prime and lambda are homothetic. So what's the proof? So imagine we have some isomorphism from C mod lambda to C mod lambda prime. Well, there's a map from C down to here, that's just the covering map. And there's a map from C to here. Now there's also a covering map from C to here. So just for purely topological reasons, since C is has trivial fundamental group, this map lifts to a map from here to here. So what do I mean by isomorphic? Here I mean isomorphic as, say, complex varieties. So what I'm assuming is that there's really a function here, f, that's holomorphic. And just because holomorphic is a local property, you see that the lifted function here, f, is also holomorphic. And then you can check, what does it mean that this is a map? It means if you take a lattice point here, what lifts to a lattice point here, then it has to go to a point in lambda. So it has to satisfy f of lambda is within lambda prime. But moreover, this map from that C in the top left-hand corner down to C, of course, it can't depend on what lift you're taking. So if you take this function f, and you take a point x, and you add lambda, and you subtract f of x, so these are two different lifts of some point x, then they have to go to the same point here, which means their difference has to lie inside lambda prime. But of course this is discrete, which means that this has to actually be constant, and then you can take the derivative with respect to x, and you see that the derivative function is equal to zero, so you see this function, which is the derivative of this map, is actually invariant under translation by points in the lattice. So again, for the same reason, it's holomorphic and periodic, therefore taking some fundamental domain, it has to be bounded, and therefore by Liouville's theorem, has to be constant. So this function has to be constant. So what does that mean about this function? It means that this function has to be linear. So f of x has to equal ax, well, let me say mu x plus a constant. Now, on the other hand, you can always translate. Translation gives you an if you take C and you take the map z goes to z plus a constant, that gives you an isomorphism of C mod lambda with itself. You're just translating yourself around the lattice. So by precomposing with such a translation, you can assume that this is true, and from that you see that you get that mu prime is equal to mu lambda. Similarly, if you have such an identity working backwards, sorry, these are floating boards. Ah, excellent. Working backwards, you get an isomorphism between these two such things. Okay. So what are these equations here? Well, these equations are exactly elliptic curves. Over C. So essentially what we just proved is that there's an equivalence between elliptic curves and lattices up to homotherty. All right. I guess we can be a little bit more precise about what this says. So given any lattice equal omega 1 and omega 2, so up to homotherty, we can always write this as a lattice of the form tau and 1, simply just scaling, dividing through by omega 2. So we can somehow represent a lattice by a single tau, which this ratio has to now be not in R, so the imaginary part of tau is not equal to 0. But again, for the same reason that omega 1 and omega 2 aren't determined by lambda, similarly, you can't immediately determine tau from lambda. So you might ask, well, what happens if instead you took a different basis? Then after homotherty, if you try to write this in this form, you would get the ratio of this but this with this, which, if tau is equal to omega 1 and omega 2, is the same as A tau plus B on C tau plus D of 1. Okay. So that gives you a correspondence now between this set and this set, and the third set, which is tau in C, with an imaginary part not equal to 0, modulo out the action where you have to identify two taus if they satisfy a relation of this form. So modulo an action of the group GL2Z. Okay. So one can be, if you observe the following, so let's suppose I let H just consist of tau in C, such the imaginary part of tau is bigger than 0. So this left-hand side is H and minus H. So you're taking H and minus H, modulo the action of GL2Z. But GL2Z has a determinate map, and the determinant is always plus or minus 1. And you see that if you take a matrix and you act on tau, and you look at the imaginary part will have the same sign if the determinant is positive, and we'll have the opposite sign if the determinant is negative. So you can just also rewrite this as H, where you just choose the determinant so you get in the right side, but now you just have to take H modulo the action of SL2Z. So here are three things that are in equivalence. So points in H modulo SL2Z, lattices up to homotherty, and elliptic curves. So for the rest of the time, I want to talk now about modular forms. So I want to give, in some sense, three or four definitions of modular forms and reconcile them all using these equivalences. Okay. So definition one, which is possibly the most familiar but in some sense the most useless, well, and completely random when you first see it, is that F, so a modular form of weight k, is a holomorphic function on H such that what satisfies f of a tau plus b on c tau plus d is c tau plus d to the k to this somewhat ridiculous looking functional equation. So that's functional equation, and there's also another condition, namely, and let me just put this in quotes, say bounded at infinity, which literally we can write in the following form, which is that the limit of tau goes to I infinity of f of tau is bounded. So some boundedness condition. All right. So that's, in some sense, one definition, which is, I think, a terrible one. That definition two, which I think is already much better, is that a modular form of weight k is a function on lattices such that, well, maybe I should say holomorphic function on lattices such that, well, it's not invariant, it's not the same on two lattices that are homothetic, but if you take two homothetic lattices, there's some relation between them, namely f of mu times lambda is equal to mu to the minus k times f of lambda. Let me just, in case it's not clear, in all these definitions, k is an integer. Okay. So you might be worried about what I mean by holomorphic. Of course, you can think of the lattices defined in terms of two variables, omega 1 and omega 2, and so it can be holomorphic in those variables. You can also think about it in terms of t and holomorphic in that variable, and these are all somehow the same. And plus, the same bounded at infinity condition, namely that if t goes to I infinity of f, well, you can take the lattice consisting of tau and 1 and say that this is bounded. Okay. Yes. Oh, yes, okay. Yeah, maybe it doesn't quite make sense. It will be it's a consequence of these definitions that the limit actually exists and is not equal to infinity. But C is not ordered, so, yes. Okay, so it's not so hard to see that these are the same definition, because, of course, there's an equivalence between, well, given a lattice, well, the lattice is, up to homothety, something of the form t, 1, and so using this, you'll get a definition for any, if you have a function like this, you'll get a definition for all lattices just by using this property, and you'll see exactly that, it's exactly here. You can see exactly these two lattices, the homothety constant that you're dividing through is this c tau plus d, which you're now dividing through, which is why you get c tau plus d to the power of k. So there's already some sense of more natural definition that comes out. So definition three. So in light of this equivalence, it would be nice to give a definition in terms of elliptic curves. So for definition three, we want something in terms of elliptic curves. So the problem that you first encounter here is that, well, it can't be a function on elliptic curves, because elliptic curves already somehow don't know anything about the lattice up to homotety. They know the lattice, but all homothetic lattices give the same thing, and somehow the function is not invariant under this translation unless k is equal to zero. So it's not obviously somehow a function. It's not somehow obviously a function on elliptic curves. So what we need to do is think a little bit more carefully about this first equivalence between elliptic curves and lattices up to homotony. So we need to refine the equivalence elliptic curves, lattices up to homotony. Okay. And the way to do that is to think, how do we actually prove this equivalence? What we did was we started with a lattice, and we wrote down an explicit elliptic curve. So somehow the map from lattices to elliptic curves is really somehow a well-defined, precise map. So we proved, of course, if lattices are the same as the homotety, they give us isomorphic elliptic curves, but they don't give us the same Weierstrass equation. So there's some issue about, like, what extra information, for example, does the Weierstrass equation have that the elliptic curve does not? Okay. So we make the following mark. So C has a differential. I guess in Canada I can call this dz. Okay. And this is certainly invariant under translation. Dz plus lambda is dz plus d lambda, and lambda is constant, so it's equal to zero. So this descends to a differential on the quotient c mod lambda. So what does that mean? That means if you take a lattice, yeah. You get not from this lattice, I mean, you certainly get the elliptic curve, but you get the elliptic curve together with a differential dz. Yeah. Okay. So a differential, which is an element of 80 c mod lambda omega 1. So all I'm saying... You get a differential in this case. So let's just think about this space and exactly what it is. So what is a differential? I mean, differential is in some sense a formal symbol which locally looks like a holomorphic function times dz. So what does this space look like? Well, let's just suppose you take two differentials. So locally they look like a function times dz. So the ratio of two differentials is just a function. So what is this? These are the differentials that are somehow holomorphic everywhere. So the ratio, if there were two things in here, so given, maybe I don't want to call them omega 1, so given, say, eta 1 and eta 2 in this space, their ratio eta 1 divided by eta 2 will be some function, a meromorphic function on C mod lambda. So in particular, dz is one of our functions, so the only other differentials, so any eta that's a differential in here is of the form some function times dz. Well, of course, that's not so hard to see, just even by lifting it to c, you'll get a differential. But you can see, therefore, any other differential is going to, at some point, because f is now going to have to be invariant under lambda, f is going to have a pole or be constant. And if f has a pole, say at some point c, the differential doesn't have a zero, so this couldn't possibly be a nice holomorphic differential. You can't somehow integrate it around that point because you'll get some infinities. So in particular, this space is, well, isomorphic to c. It's just one dimensional and it's generated by this. But what we get from this lambda is not just the elliptic curve. We get the elliptic curve and a differential, which is somehow a unique element in this one-dimensional vector space. And this one-dimensional, this unique thing, exactly records the scaling. Right, so I just somehow want to compare C mod lambda and C mod mu lambda. So, well, again, this procedure, so here, you, in both cases, you have a differential dz, and here, differential dz. But the isomorphism between C mod lambda and C mod mu lambda doesn't preserve dz, it multiplies it by lambda. And you can also see exactly the Weierstrass equation will change. Well, how do you see how the Weierstrass equation changes? Just to say, record the definition, for example, of x, which is, say, roughly 1 on x minus lambda squared in lambda, modulo infinity, z, thank you. So now if you replace this by mu lambda, this gets replaced by mu, and then therefore the isomorphism from one to the other is extending z to z mu, so you put a mu in here, and x is going to change. So in other words, here if I have y squared equals 4x cubed, and let me just call these now ax minus b, and here I have y squared equals 4x cubed minus ax minus b, well, you can see that x will equal little x divided by mu squared, y will equal little y divided by mu cubed, a will equal little a divided by mu to the 4, and b will equal little z divided by mu to the 6, and finally dz, remember before we had the dx dz was equal to y, which you can also phrase as dx dy is equal to dz. So how does the differential change? I said it changes by a scalar mu. You can also see it here. Dx is going to change by 1 on mu squared. Y is going to change by 1 on mu cubed. And so what you see is that dx on y is equal to, if I got this, I always get this constant wrong somehow. So someone's going to tell me this is wrong. So mu inverse times dx dy. Or maybe it's, did I get the power of mu wrong? Okay, good. Okay. So in other words, if we want to think about a modular form as being a function of elliptic curve, well, we can't just do it for elliptic curve because we forget about the scaling. But what we can do to remember it again is to remember an element it wants to hide but can't get away, an element of, we can remember a specific global differential which gives something up the scalar. So this allows us to get now to definition 3. Mu, yeah, that good. Someone's well, you can decide for your own what the correct scaling is. Yes. Well, Well, plus or minus one. Well, will not worry us too much. Okay. So this allows us to make definition 3, which is that a modular form of weight k is now a function on pairs consisting of an elliptic curve and a differential. So here, omega is an element of H0E. This is just my lattice C mod lambda, but I don't want to write it as C mod lambda because that somehow secretly sort of suggests I know what lambda is. the differential. Such that F of E, if you scale the differential by some constant, I wrote this down so I will have the right power here, then you simply get the scaled function I did write it down. F mu times mu to the power of k. Let me just check if that's k or minus k. I think it's k. Okay. Okay, and there's something else that we have to add, bounded at infinity, which I won't make precise now, but I will make precise quite soon. All right. So this is a fine definition, but ultimately we want to work in a context in which we're not completely tied to a sort of complex analytic point of view. Okay. So in other words, we want to think more geometrically and more algebraic geometrically. So let's think now about this quotient H mod SL2Z. So many of you will know, possibly all of you will know, that you can write a fundamental domain for the action of H on the upper half plane. It looks something like this, where here you have the interior of this region and you have this edge and this edge, and if you want to include this edge and this edge, you have to identify this with this and identify this with this. And so particularly when you take the quotient, you get some nice topological space. Here we just have a piece of paper, you glue this together and you get something that looks like a cylinder, and then at the bottom you glue the bottoms of the cylinder together, so now you kind of have a box type thing, but here this is somehow now something at infinity, so you get something that looks like the following. Here you have I infinity up here, and you have to be a little bit careful at I and rho. This is a perfectly good topological picture, but of course this is also a complex analytic. I mean, this also has a complex structure, so you can ask what complex structure do you get here. Well, you have to be a little bit careful, namely at this point, I, there are these cone points, namely the angle around I is just equal to 2 pi on 2, and your angle around rho is equal to 2 pi on 3. Why do I act on the right? So, well, of course, there's a well-known theorem that says that right actions are equivalent to left actions if you take appropriate transpose. What I wrote down on the board is left action. Okay. All right. So your first entry into the competition, who hopefully doesn't have too many more entrants. Making fun of the speaker for my inaccuracy. So, well, if you would prefer that, then I'll do this. Okay, I'll give in because I have no good response. Okay, so we want to think about this geometrically in terms of some. Well, it's not going to be a function on this. So the question is exactly what is it going to be. So, in order to sort of avoid avoid telling things that are just patently wrong. I want to just make the following remark. So everything we've said so far sort of may be refined to deal with, instead of just lattices, but lattices with some extra structure to deal with so-called level structure. When instead of a lattice, you replace lattices, say, by lattices with a point P where, say, n times P is in the lattice, but no smaller multiple of P is in the lattice. So this is some extra structure. So namely, now two lattices might be equivalent, but they might send this point to a different point. So the point might not be equivalent under the lattice. So you have some extra structure, and you again have correspondences now between these lattices with extra structure, again up to homotheta, and elliptic curves with some extra structure. Okay. So again, if you think about lattices with level structure and the corresponding T and 1, well now again T1 is not always the same as A tau plus B, C tau plus D, because you have to worry about what's happening to the other point. But so you get T now in the upper half plane, but now up to some equivalence by some group gamma, where gamma is a subgroup of SL2Z that contains a group gamma n, which is just the kernel of gamma to SL2Z mod nZ. Okay. And so this amounts to dealing with modular forms with level structure, but Florian will probably say a little bit more about this in this lecture, but the reason I wanted to say that was because this geometric picture here is complicated for various reasons, in the sense that because it's not exactly a complex manifold at these points, there are various stacky issues that one has to worry about, but in fact one never really has to actually worry about them in this context. Well, not very much. Okay. Okay. So, all right. So the question is, well, how do we deal with this situation? So what we have is not a function on this space, but it's rather something, namely, that has this extra structure where we know about this differential. So what can we do? So we have some H mod gamma, which is going to look something like the following. Yeah. Okay. Namely, it's going to be a cover of this, so it'll be some surface which covers this in some finite map, and you'll have above infinity, there'll be various points, so it'll be some Riemann surface with various cusps. And points here will correspond to, again, elliptic curves, but together with some level structure. Okay. All right. So what do we have now over this curve? So we have a curve, and for each point, we have an elliptic curve. So we can consider a surface. So now I mean a complex surface, which consists of this as a base, and over this base, something bigger that maps to this, which just consists of simply attaching at each point somehow the corresponding elliptic curve. So this is now a family of elliptic curves, which give you at each point the corresponding elliptic curve to that point. That's the way to do it. All right. So, all right. That's not going to work. All right. So we have this family of elliptic curves, and we have this point x. And so, what do we know? What is a modular form? Well, a modular form at each point x, we have an elliptic curve x, and we have some rule that gives you a function. Whenever you give yourself something in EX and an element and a differential at that point. So of course what we'd like to do is turn this, instead of thinking about a function, turn this into a section of say some local system that's varying around this curve. So somehow we want something that locally at this point is giving us this one-dimensional space that is somehow naturally associated with this elliptic curve EX. All right. So we have this E, mapping to this quotient, which I'll call y of gamma. So via this map pi. So what one can do is the following. So namely, on E, there's some sheaf which consists of the differentials on E that are somehow locally constant over this curve. So we have the sheaf up here, and we can take omega just to be the push forward of this. So this is a construction, and what does it give? Well, let's now think of what the stalk of omega is at some point x. Well, hopefully, if this is varying in a sufficiently nice way, this will just somehow be what happens when you specialize this to x. So what happens if you specialize this to x? You get a point here, and you just have h0 of the elliptic curve here, ex, and omega 1. Okay. And in fact, this is true because this map is proper, so it has this appropriate property. So in particular, one doesn't have to worry so much about exactly the construction, but namely there is some nice local system, even some nice line bundle on this curve, such that its stalk at x is the appropriate thing. And we can see exactly the transformation that we want. We namely want to see or define modular forms of weight k as sections of h0 of y gamma and omega to the power of k. Right? Sort of exactly transforming by replacing this by a scalar lambda or mu, it gets changed by mu to the power of k. So we want to take the kth tensor power of this, and then the appropriate section will transform in the appropriate way. Now, of course, this is bad for two reasons. One, remember I talked about this boundedness infinity condition. So that's a problem because I haven't said anything about that here. And it's also a problem if you think about what these things are. If you think about these are Riemann surfaces but with points missing. So in algebraic geometry language, they are, say, projective, well, you take a projective curve and then you remove some points. And if you think about that, well, that's going to be an affine curve. And if you take sections of sheaves on affine curves, they tend to be infinite dimensional. So somehow both issues are really the same, and they can be resolved by namely taking an appropriate compactification of these things. Well, the other one's gone, but you can kind of fill in the point. And then the sheaf omega extends in a natural way to a sheaf on this curve X. And then it's correct, so this is almost, but exactly what we want is sections of h0 x gamma omega to the k. So what you see immediately from this definition, well, what you get now, for example, is you get that these spaces are finite dimensional because they're the cohomology of some projective space and some nice coherent sheaf. And moreover, since you have a curve, you can, for example, try to use Riemann-Roch to compute the dimension of these spaces. So, for example, the sheaf omega squared is very ample. So, therefore, the dimension of this space is given by Riemann-Roch if k is at least 2. Okay. When k is equal to 1, Riemann-Roch actually doesn't tell you anything, and that's a sort of situation in which modular forms of weight 1 are somehow quite different from modular forms of general weight. All right, so that's the third definition, and I want to finish by giving a fourth definition, which I'm going to restrict myself to the case where k is equal to 2, but I'll maybe say something about it at the end. And this is also perhaps a little bit familiar. So if you think about k is equal to 2, we need to just go back to the original definition. You have a tau plus b on c tau plus d is c tau plus d squared times f of tau. So if you can compute the differential of A tau plus B on C tau plus D, you can see, if you assume that this is in GL2, SL2, Z, that the derivative of A tau plus B on C tau plus B is probably has a tau in it somewhere, is D tau on C tau plus D. So what this says is the weight 2 forms F tau plus tau is, it's a differential on H invariant under gamma is SL2Z. Okay. So in particular, if you have a modular form, this suggests of thinking of a modular form of weight equal to 2 as now a global section, well, of Y, and hopefully over this compactification, of just differentials on this curve. Okay. So you have to be a little bit careful because, again, this description is really just telling you something of what's happening over Y of gamma. So you might ask, well, what's happening at infinity? So if you think about what this boundedness condition is, this boundedness condition seems to suggest that at infinity you should get something nice. But that's not quite so, just for the following elementary reason. Namely, when tau goes to I infinity, if you want to think about this curve and its completion, you want to think what's a local parameter at that point. Well, local parameter is given by Q is equal to e to the 2 pi I tau. And this parameter Q, well, you see that dq divided by 2 pi I q is equal to d tau. Okay, so if you have something of the form f of tau d tau, where f is bounded, and then you think about it as f of q times dq divided by q with the 2 pi I, what you'll see is that if f is bounded, this could now have some pole of order 1. So you have to account for this, and I apologize, I'm going to have another. You have to allow a pole at the cusp. So I don't know if I want to say plus infinity or minus infinity. So maybe I'll just write cusps. I forget the notation. We're allowing to have a single pole at infinity. Okay. So this is another description. Just to reconcile that with the previous definition, in fact, there is an isomorphism of this sheaf omega squared with omega 1 cusps. And in some sense, our computations prove that this is true. It doesn't literally do that. The computations prove that this is true on the open curve, and you just need to check the orders at the final points. Actually, I'm just going to skip this board. All right. Okay. All right, so in this description, we have some understanding of modular forms. Well, in all these descriptions, something in terms of coherent cohomology of some local systems. But there's other cohomologies that any varieties have, and you might ask, well, are there nice descriptions in terms of other cohomology groups? Well, so what other cohomology groups are there? Well, we can take just, say, the singular cohomology of these curves. Let's just stick with coefficients in C for now. Or we can also take the Durham cohomology in curves. All right. So since I have coefficients of C, these are basically the same. So the question is, how can we relate them to these other constructions? So at least in this construction here, well, here we have something that looks like differentials, and differentials sound like they have something to do with Durham cohomology. And in fact, somehow for curves, there is an exact sequence, H1 of, H0 of X, omega 1, mapping to H1, Durham, mapping to H1X of OX to 0. Okay. So, for example, this we understand in terms of module forms of weight 2. Here's some cohomology that we want to think about in terms of module forms, perhaps, and here's something else. Okay, so what is this? This is just, what is this theorem basically coming from? So let me just say a few words instead of writing it down. So we're looking at the first Durham cohomology. So what is Durham cohomology? You have some differential that you can integrate, and you integrate it against a one form, against some one loop, and that's a pairing, and that gives you something here. So you can think about something in here. I mean, this is a surface, so it looks like ADX plus BDY. Okay. So it turns out that if you actually have a non-trivial cohomology class in Durham cohomology, you can represent it by a kind of nice class. So by nice class, well, not necessarily complex analytic, because your manifold doesn't even have to be complex analytic, but you can always represent something here by a harmonic form. So a harmonic form, well, I guess I really can't define harmonic form if you haven't seen it before, but it boils down to satisfying some differential equation. And it's a very explicit differential equation, and for curves, so in the one-dimensional case, if you have something like ADX plus BDY, it almost essentially says that these functions A and B satisfy equations that look like the Cauchy-Riemann equations. So if you actually literally had that, you would be able to write this as a literally a complex one form, and then you have something in here. But you don't quite get that because it's somehow a second-order thing. So you either get the Cauchy-Riemann equations or its conjugate. So in other words, what you get is somehow either complex analytic forms or anti-complex or anti-holomorphic forms. So you can imagine you have holomorphic forms here, but you also have, say, forms that instead of looking like dz or dz, they look like dz bar. So it's a little bit strange maybe why you have this rather than just somehow another copy of this or some complex conjugate of this. But by fair duality, this is isomorphic to H0X omega joule. So that's another way of seeing here you have the holomorphic things and the anti-holomorphic things inside here. So in other words, what you get here is really two copies, at least as a vector space, of the space of module forms. So this is another way to see the module forms, at least of weight 2, but now in terms of Durham cohomology, which you can also then think of in terms of singular cohomology. Well, of course, by seeing them is not necessarily, I mean, how much are we seeing? At the moment, we just have vector spaces, and to see the dimension of a vector space is not telling you so much information. But in fact, this is well-behaved with respect to things like Hecke operators. And so in particular, since Hecke operators carry the most interesting information about the modular form, you also have another space in which you can view this. And in fact, more generally, you can think of modular forms of weight k, and they have a relation, again, not exactly the same thing, just because here we really had the modular forms arising as actual objects. Here we have things that are equivalent in some way. So now to the cohomology, where this can sort of, well, say it's singular, now in some local system, namely sim of k minus 2 of r squared. So all I just mean, without sort of saying exactly what this is just some local system, and some points to take away from this description, for example, is this only works if k is bigger than 2. Yeah. C squared, yes, thank you. Okay. So, alright, so my time is essentially up, but what I want to somehow at least sort of have roughly described is that there's really many different ways of thinking about a module form, And in their description, various descriptions are useful for different purposes. For example, once you have some description like this in terms of singular cohomology, you can maybe start to think about a tautomology. On the other hand, already there are some strange things. For example, here you have to have k is bigger or equal to 2. So in the first description we gave in terms of current cohomology, we didn't really see any difference between k is equal to 1 and k is bigger or equal to 2, except for the very ampleness. But here, there is a little bit of difference. And part of the reason is that for modular forms, a whole bunch of things that are different in general coincide. And so it's hard exactly to distinguish. Of course, when everything specializes to the same thing, it's nice because it means you can look at it in different ways. But then in general, we'll sort of see what things are the right way to look at it in general and what things have to be modified. All right. So we should pause now until we have some tea, and then maybe 11:30 we'll start again.